is the main event.
What you gonna do?
If you're so mad.
Best there is, best there was, best there ever will be.
Woo! Yeah!
Ooh, yeah!
I am the game.
Cause Stone Cold said so.
Oh my God!
What I'd like to have right now.
Rest in peace.
What a rush.
To be the man, you gotta beat the man.
Are you ready?
Everyone has a price.
Yeah, I come here to fight.
Standing ovation here. Let's go to our ring announcer.
Introducing your old school pro wrestling nostalgia podcast, Beyond the Bell.
Class is in session. Welcome back, students, to ECW 101, the history of Extreme Championship Wrestling here on Beyond the Bell, your pro wrestling nostalgia podcast exclusively on the SNS Radio Network. Professor Sean Beckerman back with you to cover all things extreme in professional wrestling as we dive into the history and what it was like to be in the year 1999 on the land of the extreme. It's been a while since we took a trip back in time to relive the hardcore organization. When we last left you, we covered 1998. That chapter was full of ups and downs for the promotion, and 1999 would surely be the same. On the horizon of getting a national television deal with TNN, ECW was on the cusp of quite possibly breaking the mark to become the number two organization in the world, especially in North America. As WCW was declining, it left an opening for ECW and their hot product to take a hold of that spot. But things took a turn. A lot of twists and turns for Paul Heyman's group. A lot of ups and downs, like I stated. A lot of behind-the-scenes actions taking place, a lot of which hardcore fans didn't even know of. All this will be covered on this edition. Retro audio from this time in 1999 will be covered as we take a trip back to the return of some former extremists, extreme stars, some departures, world champions leaving the organization, some funny tales of behind the scenes between ECW superstars, and some classic promos from suplex machines to full-blooded Italians to the whole effing show to the new effing show, from impact players to homicidal, suicidal, genocidal superstars and hardcore icons returning. Go back in time tonight to relive all this on ECW 101, Chapter 1999. But first, before we kick off this hardcore trip back in time, I wanted to speak a little bit about WWE 2K15 coming out in just a few short weeks, a little under 2 months away. I mentioned 2 weeks ago I wanted to cover 2K15 and what we've heard and the anticipation and the excitement going into this revolutionary game, but there weren't much to discuss, especially during part two of our SummerSlam Feuds edition. And the same could be said even this week, but I want to discuss it as I did mention it previously. From what we've seen so far, A couple things to note. From what we've seen so far, it looks extraordinary. Realism like we've never seen before in a professional wrestling game. I am so excited to just get in depth and just play this game hours upon hours. I'm very big into realistic simulated games, as I love playing sports games to simulate them as we do on television. That really appeals to me. I'm a big Sims guy, SimCity. I like the realistic type of environments. And that's what we see with this specific game. It looks unreal just by seeing four characters. The entrances of Goldust, Randy Orton, then seeing Cesaro and John Cena, from Cesaro's neck crank to grabbing the ropes to wipe the sweat off his hands. Realism to a T. Now, like others have mentioned, what is cause for concern is that there was not much video to see. Not much was released. Yes, they had the 2K15 roster reveal headed by Stone Cold Steve Austin, but they didn't discuss, or should I say, they gave you the roster, but it was more so the current active roster of superstars. I'm surprised to see Justin Gabriel in the game, Tyson Kidd, amongst some others that were surprised to be in this game, considering the lack of time they were on WWE television. But considering the modes that we've heard, NXT mode kind of makes sense. Maybe Gabriel Kidd will be in that mode. Now it kind of falls into the next question, is what superstars were missing? Rumors have ran rampant that it shows that there's 92 slots, 92 character boxes seen in the game-tested versions that we've seen on YouTube and have been posted on WWEgaming.com, as well as the SmackDown Hotel, two famous sites, I'll give them plugs, as well as we see on the SNS Radio Network. But we only see four characters you could play with at the time, and they gave a good list of characters thus far. I think approximately 62 playable characters, which leaves 30 supposedly open. Now rumors have ran rampant that there quite possibly could be over 100 characters in the game thus far, making it the biggest roster ever in a professional wrestling video game. What can you say? Amazing, right? The opportunity to create your own stars. I'm excited to see the creation suite. Not a lot has been released of the game. It's cause for concern. It's also cause for excitement. Are they holding back on purpose to want to blow everybody's mind? Or are they still rushing the game through or tweaking the game? Hopefully there'll be some last-minute additions, as with the new WWE logo into effect. We saw it in the lower left-hand corner, but now WWE has done they've taken the color away from the logo and putting it in the lower right-hand corner. Hopefully that transition will be made in the game. Plus, the new WWE logo on the ramp for Raw and SmackDown. Right now, from what we've seen, it has the old logo on the ramp for the superstar entrances that we've seen thus far. Hopefully those small changes can be made. Granted, I think the entranceway may be a little bit tougher. I'm not sure how much of the renderization, or because I'm not big into the back end of video gaming, even though I love it, I want to learn more about it. I'm not sure how much it will take to switch that logo from the old to the new, the scratch to the network. Maybe it's a little bit easier to change the on-screen to that colorless, you know, kind of clear, see-through, lower right-hand network logo. The brand new WWE logo, which I think they would have done anyway. Well, maybe they didn't know that the WWE was going to switch the placement of the logo. I'm rambling. Nevertheless, all these are questions that are coming up. What is going to happen with WWE 2K15 in the coming weeks? I'm sure as we get more closer and closer and get more and more information, we'll get to talk more and more about it on Beyond the Belt. And I hope to dedicate a whole show to, in preparation and in celebration of the game, as it's another component, another area I love and an interest of mine, as is wrestling music, the accessory side of professional wrestling. That's what I love, and we'll discuss that here on Beyond the Bell. But I want to hear your thoughts. Let me know what you think. If you've heard some rumors or heard some facts come through, shoot it at me. Let me know. Send it on Twitter, also btbcast.com. And I would love to talk about storylines. The Universe mode will be back, thank goodness. 2K Showcase mode, CM Punk in the game, which is good to hear, and the opportunity to relive classic storylines. I'm excited about Triple H versus Shawn Michaels, reliving that 2002 SummerSlam feud in which we discussed on Beyond the Bell on our previous editions. What a great matchup between the two. What a great feud rivalry. You could relive CM Punk versus John Cena from Money in the Bank. Then you could purchase additional feuds, of course, via the shop, you know, online, the marketplace, what have you. And of course, they'll expand more and more on that. Who could be in the DLC pack? Could it be Adam Rose, Rusev, those that were on the border of coming on board, Bo Dallas, around the cutoff, the roster cutoff date for 2K? So many questions. What legends? Diesel supposedly confirmed he was in the game. Could Razor Ramon, Jake the Snake, Dusty Rhodes? Could they throw Stardust in there? All this, hopefully, we can answer in the coming weeks. Now, on to the live show from 2 weeks ago, right before SummerSlam. Thank you so much, for everyone, for listening. Great feedback once again, as from our previous live edition, and I hope to carry more live editions for you in the coming months. We'll give you some preparation on that, as I would like to do some call-ins, possibly. Extend the show an extra half hour and have some call-ins in preparation. Maybe we'll do even more live shows that aren't pregame shows going forward, as I like to interact with the fans. But it was a great half hour in preparation, going over Mr. SummerSlam, my top five favorite SummerSlam moments, and go back and see if my predictions were correct. And you want to relive some of the greatest SummerSlams of all time and see which ones I was lucky enough to attend. And maybe you can argue, debate of who you think Mr. SummerSlam is. So the live edition is now archived at snsradionetwork.com and btbcast.com. And speaking of predictions, what about what actually happened at SummerSlam? Just as I thought, maybe not in the fashion that I quite would have predicted, Brock Lesnar, the Beast Incarnate, defeated John Cena to become the WWE World Heavyweight Champion. Never, ever in the history of this industry have we seen such a beating in a world title match. Now, challenge, just like Barney Stinson says, challenge accepted. I've thought of a great idea for a future Beyond the Bell, as we're going to analyze some of the greatest one-sided title matches in professional wrestling history. We won't limit it just to world titles, but as well as any championship, some of the lopsided championship confrontations in wrestling history. So expect that to come over the next few months on Beyond the Bell, as it's a great topic, very unique one, and very fitting for the time, as we'll discuss the lopsided victories in championship matchups. Perfect matchup for Brock Lesnar. Fits what happened at WrestleMania, defeating The Undertaker. He has to come in and out of it strong, and he did. No one at John Cena's level of status has ever done that before, has ever took a beating like that before. You think Stone Cold Steve Austin would have? You think Hulk Hogan? Not even Bret Hart, in a sense. Shawn Michaels has taken beatings, but he was a heel at times. Never the big-time babyface has taken that big of a beating in a main event marquee matchup at arguably the second biggest event of the year. With that said, a great move, because now Brock Lesnar is the World Heavyweight Champion. Some say, no, why? You can't have a show without the champion on regularly. Yes, you can. It's old school booking. That's why I'm mentioning on Beyond the Bell. Very rarely do we discuss what happens on the current day product on Beyond the Bell on a regular basis. But I wanted to discuss this storyline because it's old school. It brings us back to the territory days. We're starting to advertise our WCW 101 series that we've had over the previous years on Beyond the Bell, as we're re-releasing a compilation of them so you guys can go back to relive that series. Students, get ready. WCW 101 is being re-released for you guys in the archives. You can go back and listen to it now at btbcast.com. But in that series, we discussed Nature Boy Ric Flair's title run. And I'm sure, well, we will talk about it more extensively when we discuss Ric Flair's career in depth in his biography series as we chronicle his career. During that time, Ric Flair would travel from country to country, state to state, territory to territory, defending the NWA title. As a result, he wasn't able to be on WCW or Georgia Championship Wrestling television every week. Made it special when you see the champion. You weren't seeing the title holder in the main event of every single weekly show. You had to pay to see him wrestle, or it had to be a special event. Bring it to the Northeast and Hulk Hogan. He didn't wrestle on every single WWF superstar show, not on primetime wrestling. Saturday night's main event will be an opportunity for him to wrestle as a big event to see the champion wrestle. It's a throwback. You have to wait and pay to see Brock Lesnar. You have to anticipate and yearn to see the Beast Incarnate defend the title. It puts more stock in the championship. And when his eventual conqueror takes over the title and defeats him, it will mean that much more, as more time, more prestige, more honor is put into that championship. It's a throwback. It's old school. I like it. And we'll relive this type of storyline further on Beyond the Bell, which I'm so excited to do because it's so easy in my eyes to go back to the old school ways and just and tweak them for the modern age. Now, I'm not in the business at a level of Vince McMahon, of course, or Jim Ross, who has great opinions, and I agree with most of his opinions, actually. I don't think it's too hard to implement old school booking styles and making them modern for 2014. This will be a perfect example of that. Coincidentally, the Intercontinental Championship being put in the hands of Dolph Ziggler. Another great move because you're putting the babyface now as the Intercontinental Champion. Therefore, when he goes on the house show run, defends and retains the title, it sends the fans home happy, as typically that's what you want to do when you're on the house show circuit. Vince loved having the two world titles to defend on A and B house shows, because you can have a title ending the show. Now you can say the brand is bigger than the titles, the brand is bigger than the person or the superstar, but titles should mean something. And they should mean that the person holding the title is the number one person that should be the champion. Or this storyline should put more emphasis on the Intercontinental title, as now this is the title to go for, as it's the only weekly seen championship, the most commonly sought after championship on a show-by-show basis. The United States title should be pushed up a little bit as well. Maybe that you look at the IC title as your main title in a sense. Then the U.S. title gets pushed up a little bit. I don't think you should merge them right now, at least, because more titles, I'm not saying have tons of championships, but with the amount of television time you have, it warrants having multiple titles. With the hours upon hours of WWE television, 6 hours, whatever it is, of brand new content every week, you need additional championships to shoot for, to vie for. If you put more effort into that U.S. title, it could be just that. The Intercontinental title could come out of this reaping the best benefits of reclaiming that status. And I'm glad Dolph Ziggler's in that spot. I'm glad that the IC title hopefully will be put at a more prominent level, as it could be possibly a main event at Raw on more occasions. Or definitely on house shows, it should be the last or next to last match if you're having a John Cena, you know, or eventually Daniel Bryan come back. Roman Reigns, you're prepping for that main event role. But you can have that IC title, as I mentioned the past couple weeks, that Intercontinental title should be that main title now that you're shooting for, because you don't see the world title regularly, and you have to be that top tier to go after Brock Lesnar. But that's just my rant on championships and where they should be placed in professional wrestling. I think some of you agree, as you've mentioned via your comments and feedback. I haven't had many disagreements on the championships, but a lot of you think they should combine the U.S. and IC titles. But after coming out of SummerSlam, the World Heavyweight title should be put at a higher level, and as well as the Intercontinental title. We'll see if that truly happens. So get ready, buckle up, get your barbed wire baseball bats, steel chairs, flaming tables ready, as after this quick break, we're going to dive deep into the land of the extreme in 1999. First, let's take some time to thank the sponsors of Beyond the Bell and the SNS Radio Network. And when we return, get ready, students. ECW 101 Extreme Championship Wrestling in 1999.
Are you a fan of wrestling shoot DVDs, wrestling action figures, wrestling memorabilia? The SNS Radio Network is an affiliate of HighSpots.com. So when you go to the SNS Radio Network site, click on the HighSpots banner on the main page, and it takes you directly to HighSpots. Now, I'm not saying you need to buy something from HighSpots.com, but if you do, you're helping to support the SNS Radio Network by going through HighSpots on the link on the SNS Radio Network page. And every purchase gives a kickback to the SNS Radio Network, helping us keep all the programming here free for you.
If you trained, say your prayers, and ate your vitamins, then you'll love The Hulkamania Chronicles. Sean Beckerman, host of Beyond the Bell, your pro wrestling nostalgia podcast, breaks down the history and career of the legendary Hall of Famer, the immortal Hulk Hogan. Each edition covers a different era in the history of the Hulkster as we relive our childhood hero. From the beginning of Hulkamania in the mid-80s and the birth of WrestleMania, through the challenging times of the steroid trial, all the way to his jump to WCW and the formation of Hollywood Hogan and the New World Order, and then his return to the WWF leading in to the Hall of Fame. This edition covers it all. You can catch the Hulkamania Chronicles exclusively on Beyond the Bell here on the SNS Radio Network, brother.
This is Christopher Daniels, and the gospel according to the Fallen Angels says that you are listening to the SNS Radio Network.
Students, we start off this next class of ECW 101 with January 10th of the year 1999. It was guilty as charged. The pay-per-view began the company's most ambitious and noteworthy year in, fittingly, unforgettable fashion. Taz captured the ECW heavyweight title from the franchise Shane Douglas, culminating his six-year-plus stint in the company. The match was an unqualified success, you can say, as the Brooklyn native proved to be one of the most effective champions in company history. Having evolved from a too-short Northeastern independent wrestler into the other guy in the Sabu and Taz tag team into a human suplex machine with a major chip on his shoulder. That suplex machine also cut some of the best pithy promos in the business. He was unquestionably a worthy spokesperson for ECW's bold and brazen product.
All the hype, all the talk, everybody's saying it. ECW and TNN. ECW is going to take TNN to the extreme. And you think about ECW, and you think about the guys with the barbed wire baseball bats, the guys with the most vicious chair shots in the wrestling business, the guys with the flaming tables, power bombing each other through them. And then everything settles, and you look through it all, and there's me, the world heavyweight champion, standing there with the two most vicious weapons in this business, in this federation, and that's these hands. You see, I don't need a weapon. My hands are my weapons. You can ask all the supposed superstars that been through the doors of Extreme Championship Wrestling, the guys that I faced, the new big time, big WWF superstar, the Manilian Man, Chris Jericho. I dumped him on his head and he tapped out. Then, the guy that's supposed to take WCW to all new heights, Shane Douglas. Good luck, brother. I don't think you're back strong enough to carry that company. Shane faced me, and I took this from him. Oh, he didn't tap. He played hero. So I choked him out. I took his air from him and choked him out. Then the beast from the east, the world famous Bam Bam Bigelow, the big monster from Jersey, dumped him, hooked him, he tapped. You see, the list goes on and on. Too Cold Scorpio, threw him, he tapped. Chris Candido, dumped him, he tapped. And then that jerk, that idiot, that schmuck, Jerry the King Lawler. I choked him out, he tapped out, and that was easy. It was a night off. You see, the fact of the matter is, I'm the guy your mother warned you about. I'm the guy that ain't your kid's role model. You see, you don't want your children to grow up like me. You don't want them to do what I do. I'm not the guy that's going to go on TV and do an acting gig or hang out with the media or schmooze with the Hollywood types. I'm too busy training to defend the most prestigious title in the wrestling world today. I am the ECW World Heavyweight Champion for a reason. I live by a motto called kill or be killed. That's what I'm about. Stay tuned. Look for me. I'll be the guy with this, dumping people on their head and making them tap out. You see, my name is Taz, and I am the ECW World Heavyweight Champion. Beat me if you can. Survive if I let you.
Elsewhere on the show, another fly appeared in ECW's hardcore ointment, so to speak, in the form of a big-name guest who represented the very antithesis of everything the company was founded upon. His name was Sid Vicious. Sid debuted, and during his squash match against ex-eliminator turned enhancement wrestler John Cronus, received the biggest reaction of the show. Heyman actually made a habit out of relying on such surprise appearances throughout his pay-per-view run. Besides the previously mentioned Jake the Snake Roberts, the Junkyard Dog had appeared at WrestlePalooza 7 months earlier, since it was in close proximity to his home, while Dusty Rhodes had a brief run as an ECW star in early 2000, which we'll get into the next edition. Heyman even negotiated briefly with the Ultimate Warrior following his very failed run in 1998 in WCW. Still, the fact that several wrestlers who embodied the antithesis of the hardcore movement appeared at ECW events, it garnered enormous pops in the process, served as yet another reminder of how much the promotion had evolved from the heights of being the anti-Big Two in that spirit of 1993 through 1996. ECW had experienced more than its fair share of hardships over the years, but luckily, it had largely managed to steer clear of financial woes. Shortly after Guilty as Charged, the period of solvency ended for good for the company. At that point, ECW's prospects crashed to an all-time low amidst swirling and often slightly premature rumors regarding its impending demise. Reports of financial peril, bouncing checks, and plunging morale abounded within the company, and Heyman really was several weeks behind on payroll at one point in early 99. Some wrestlers hadn't even received bonuses from any of the 1998 pay-per-views, and to accentuate
how grave the situation was, the company could no longer even afford to fly in its lower card talent, such as Tommy Rich, Rod Price, Tracy Smothers, One Man Gang. They were a part of that group. They were unable to fly them to house shows. Even several of the company's most loyal employees began testing the free agent waters, which only dragged everyone else's sagging spirits that much lower. Heyman was notorious for being almost inept at the business side of wrestling, as he was adept at the creative side. His bookkeeping methods were clumsy, and he took out several loans over the years, including at least one from the WWF, in which we found out later on to be an ongoing payment structure with Vince McMahon. As his company grew, his want for fiscal management skills became more glaring, to the point he had no choice but to own up to them. Also, one of the main stories of the financial stress was that Heyman was now paying exorbitant sums for TV clearance in major markets to ensure his pay-per-views were more widely promoted, rather than relying on barter agreements as he had in ECW's early days.
Point. You embarrassed yourselves by spiking Bob Ortiz with a Dudley Death Drop. What are you inbreds? Just quit while you're ahead. Get the hell out of here.
$3,000 for ECW's weekly TV clearance in Chicago alone, and that was in a graveyard time slot. In fact, the $156,000 annual fee was more than he was willing to pay, all but his very top wrestlers, because the added exposure cost more than it yielded in added revenue, their price versus benefit ratio proved to be detrimental to the company's bottom line. Also, although the company was drawing very respectable crowds in markets far from its home base, between talent expenses, travel expenses, and renting larger buildings, Heyman actually lost money on many house show tours, even though they were selling out. Altogether, it had become abundantly clear that ECW desperately needed new revenue streams and a national cable deal, because the alternative was certain quick death. ECW's all-too-familiar roster problems also cropped up during the period, compounding the tense situation. As injuries continued to mount all through the talent base, Mikey Whipwreck and Chastity became the latest to jump ship to WCW in an effort to plug one of the many roster vacancies. Heyman even brought back Public Enemy for a brief run that ended on bad terms. By this point, ECW's problems also extended all the way to its very core, a fact which many of those close to the company were reluctant to concede. However, it was no longer possible to ignore that much of the focus or center of responsibility now belonging squarely on Heyman's overtaxed shoulders, and not only from a fiscal or fiscally managed or any type of management standpoint. Now at 33, ECW's mastermind was in midst of the biggest creative rut in the past 6 years, and the company's national identity was suffering because of it. As the producer, booker, talent coordinator, spokesperson, and owner of the organization, the physical, emotional, and creative toll of his several years of 100-hour work weeks was now bearing its ugly teeth and wearing on the shoulders of Heyman. It had been months, if not years, since he had booked any storylines nearly as compelling as his 94 to 95 fare. And while nobody could argue that he still showcased a nimble booking mind more often than not, the WWF's TV had now overtaken his as the most entertaining wrestling program around. With inferior production values, ECW had to have a superior creative direction to succeed at a national level. But sadly, Heyman's burnout was, understandably so, manifesting itself more distinctly than ever. The promotion attempted to put its tenuous status aside when it presented its 8th pay-per-view on March 21st, Living Dangerously 99. Remarkably, the ECW crew turned in a solid showing, despite the turmoil with Rob Van Dam versus Jerry Lynn for the television title and Taz versus Sabu for the ECW heavyweight title matches ranking as particularly strong. The company continued to live on hand to mouth for the next 2 months, and the creative direction largely remained static amidst all the turmoil. Consequently, the next pay-per-view, May 16th's Hardcore Heaven, did not usher in many memorable storyline developments, but its highlight was one of the greatest matches in the history of the company, a Rob Van Dam vs. Jerry Lynn rematch that even the most jaded and mostly irrational RVD critics gave over 4 stars. Another success during the period was the emergence of former indie star Steve Corino, whose saucy interviews and solid in-ring work quickly made him one of Team Heyman's top heels.
Do you think I'm gonna let an old fossil push me around? You see, Dusty Rhodes, the business has changed. This isn't 1985 anymore, and you're not the bull of the woods in my territory anymore. Do you have anything to say for yourself? No, I didn't think so. You see, Dusty, you're staring into the eyes of the future of professional wrestling. I have no respect for you. I never did. Look at me when I'm talking to you, Dream.
Oh, it's a dream come true. I mean, it's a pun, but I tell the story all the time. Dusty Rhodes came to Atlanta. He had just gotten released by WCW, came to Atlanta just to hang out. And I walk into the locker room, and I met Dusty. I'm like, oh, my God, you know, it's Dusty Rhodes. And Dreamer comes up to me and goes, you're working with the Dream tonight. And I go, oh, so what are we doing? And because I used to call Dreamer Dream. I'm like, hey, Dream, you know. But he goes, no, you're working with the real Dream tonight. And I walked up to him. I said, sir, you know, is there anything? We just knew we had the promo and the elbow. And I said, is there anything I can't touch on? And Bill Alfonso says to Dusty Rhodes, this kid's really good. This kid's really good, Daddy, you know. And Dusty goes, if you're as good as they say, we don't need to talk about anything. And I remember that. And we just went out and we had magic and chemistry. And it was just amazing to think that Dusty Rhodes in ECW, like, if you would have thought about it 6 months before, you would have went, no way, Dusty Rhodes would be awful in ECW. And the fans just embraced him. And I went from here to here in one promo, and it was an amazing ride. And, you know, I'll always be grateful to Dusty for it. Paul wore 30 different hats in ECW. He was the promoter, he was the booker, he was the TV producer, he was this, that, matchmaker, everything. The problem is that when you wear 30 hats, some are gonna suffer. And Paul's got a reputation for being a liar. I think that Paul is more of a guy that doesn't want to disappoint anybody. So he'll lie, or he would lie to us, but he was doing it because he wanted morale to stay high and he wanted everything to do good. I think as a promoter, he fails in the sense of he was wearing too many hats. If promotion was his only job, I think he could have done a heck of a job. You just watch what he did on the weeks leading up to the ECW One Night Stand. He had the mic and he would always hit his points. Sunday night, June 11th, live on pay-per-view. And he'd hit it 3 or 4 times in that one promo, but make it seem like he's still talking to the guy. But, you know, maybe the fan came in halfway through the promo. Oh yeah, there's pay-per-view. Let me write down that. There's pay-per-view June 11th. You know, he's good at promoting himself and stuff like that. So I think if it was his only hat, he would have been a very successful promoter. But I think when you talk about him being a booker, I think he's one of the best of all time. But the one thing is that, you know, we went like 14 weeks without getting paid because the company was in such a bad thing. But, you know, the checks that balance, I think, was more, you know, a thing right before I came in. You know, for the first couple, I think maybe 2 or 3 did, but Paul always made good on them. And, you know, if there was ever like a surcharge on from the bank and stuff like that, he always took care of it. So he took care of it right away.
Tragically, another well-documented and unsavory source of sinking locker room morale also came to the forefront during this interval. Throughout their ECW tenure, real-life couple Tammy Fitch and Chris Candido had been tormented by rumors of personal traumas or issues and substance abuse problems, but the severity of their afflictions had now become woefully apparent. On one infamous occasion, Fitch passed out following an ECW arena card, then attempted to blame the incident on someone spiking her drink. However, both she and Candido had garnered a dubious reputation for frequently showing up in no condition to perform, and nobody could ignore the former Sonny's actions and even look, as she had begun to look like a hopped up zombie, even in her heavily made up on camera appearances.
Heyman released both in May of 99, but he eventually gave them the ultimatum that they had to clean up their acts and enrolled in college or else he would never employ them again. Not surprisingly, Heyman began experiencing perpetual talent problems on the talent relations side, stemming from his shoddy pay practices. Sid severed ties with ECW in April, very short run, although whether he quit or was fired is open to interpretation. Heyman and Shane Douglas, who had been sidelined by multiple injuries, also entered into a bitter dispute, largely stemming from the franchise's concerns over the hefty amount of back pay the ECW owner and operator still owed him. What's more, Heyman had also recently fired one of Douglas's best friends in the company, a man in charge of merchandise sales. In the aftermath, Douglas opened up negotiations with the WWF and WCW, effectively ending his long-standing association with ECW in May of 99. Meanwhile, Axel Rotten's bloody ECW brawls became a thing of the past after Heyman released him, and New Jack's appearances became more sporadic during his trial regarding the November 96 the serious accident with mass transit. Finally, despite all the turmoil, and after months of frantically searching, Heyman struck a deal that gave ECW a large influx of cash and allowed him to catch up on payroll when he inked a video game distribution deal with Acclaim Incorporated, the former company that ran WWF video games. In addition to furnishing the company with a lucrative contract, the video game company invested 15% equity stock interest into ECW. For the first time in ages, the company was financially solvent, and the collective sigh of relief could be heard clear from Philadelphia to the Sandman's now defunct cane manufacturing shop in Singapore. ECW had a future, or so we thought.
The story I was thinking of was Carino.
Right, that's what I was going to say. You can tell that story.
You tell that better.
Where the only other time where we didn't have an argument, but this was legit.
Awesome.
Dreamer, Raven, being tag team partners that weren't getting along. We're fighting in the high school gym somewhere, and they had where the rope, you know, in gym they climb the ropes, and they had the rope from the ceiling to the wall. And I'm fighting Steve Carino, and I see it. And I'm like, dude, stay here. And I ram into the steps, and I come up. I unhook it, and I'm going to do a pirate swashbuckling thing right down into Carino, man. This was going to be, and I'm milking it. I grab it. I got the rope like this, and Raven out of nowhere, like our bar fight, he pickles me out of the way. I mean, dude, he bum rushed me. Like, and I'm like milking it with the people. He bum rushes me. He grabs the thing.
No, it was all in one motion, yeah. Too. And I grabbed
him. He grabs it, and I remember turning like, no. And I see him go like a swashbuckling pirate from the top of the bleachers all the way down and gives the armpit tope, and the place like ECW. Now right next to it is there's another rope, and now I'm on the top, and I'm like, I have to do it. Like, they're all looking at me like I gotta do it. So I go and I grab the rope and I go to do it, and Jack Victory's sitting there waiting for me, and Raven's holding both of them. And as I go, and I'm gonna take off, I'm gonna follow it. It was my idea. I'm gonna follow Raven. And seriously, man, he went down like a legit pirate from one ship to the other. Went from one and landed right on him. Now it's my turn, and as I go to take off, the rope is a short rope,
and it's straight overhead.
And I take off like this, and then I just start going like this in a complete circle. Like this.
What the hell was this?
This was in somewhere, and I was seriously like this, and stopped, and then started spinning in a circle.
And sliding off it.
Yeah, and sliding off it, and I had to legitimately like get off and like walk down like six more steps to go like, and I was like, I hate you.
It was great.
And he was laughing so much. It was, I've seen it on YouTube, and I think you have the tape for it. And it seriously was one of the greatest things I've ever seen.
Hot on the heels of the video game licensing agreement came even greater cause for celebration. In June, Heyman at long last reached an agreement with a national cable outlet, the Nashville Network, which previously had been characterized, so to speak, by its Walton's reruns, signed ECW to a one-year contract for a weekly Friday night program starting in September. Additionally, the slot would give Team Heyman its first TV contract in Canada, thereby allowing it to run its pay-per-views on Viewer's Choice Canada and tap into a potentially new audience base. By far, the deal gave ECW its greatest opportunity to expand its audience, and now the talk of the wrestling world centered on the promotion's potential to compete with the struggling WCW for the number two promotion bragging rights. In fact, it almost seemed as though the company's days of limping along, living hand to mouth, were completely a property of the past. Yes, ECW was flying high, in spite of the fact that the financial terms of the deal appeared on the surface to be inordinately favorable to TNN. ECW shouldered the whole of the production costs, which wound up at approximately $25,000 per week, and TNN kept a larger than customary share of the advertising revenue. But ECW wasn't in much of a place to bargain. Immediately, ECW began devising its plan of attack. It would tape 2 one-hour shows apiece at 2 monthly taping sessions. Heyman was led to believe there would be very few restrictions on content, as TNN vowed to permit blood and raunch in limited dosages. However, Paulie recognized that the WWF and WCW were not enticing to the portions of their clientele that favored athletic in-ring action over skits and comedy sketches. So he resolved to focus on quality wrestling as his niche in the oversaturated marketplace. That meant the in-ring exploits of gifted workers like Rob Van Dam, Jerry Lynn, the Impact players Lance Storm and Justin Credible, Yoshihiro Tajiri, Super Crazy, and others would be the cornerstone of the new program. The announcers were set to be Joey Styles, of course, and the always amusing Joel Gertner. TNN sold ads based on a 2.0 rating, although Heyman conceded that he had no inclination of what the ratings would actually be. In the months immediately preceding the new program, ECW simply bided its time, pacing itself in preparation for its national invasion. That meant most storylines came to a virtual standstill, though the company still had a fairly eventful Heatwave pay-per-view on July 20th. It was a strong show that reflected the lively and enthusiastic nature that now permeated the company's ranks. A terrific Rob Van Dam and Jerry Lynn vs. Impact Players tag match was the bona fide highlight. Of course, Styles and color man Don Cyrus Callis promoted the TNN show very heavily throughout the pay-per-view, and they made no efforts to conceal their genuine excitement concerning this forthcoming new era of the extreme. As always, Heyman plugged the holes in his roster as best as he could leading up to the big event. A brawny independent wrestler from Michigan named Rhino arrived on the scene, joining forces with a gifted mouthpiece in Steve Corino, and immediately displayed a breakout star potential that even overcame his inexperience. Over the summer, Heyman introduced another future star, a valet named Angelica, who seconded mid-carder Danny Doring. She barely got her feet wet in ECW before the WWF signed her and turned her into Lita. She was also known as Miss Congeniality in ECW. Unfortunately for ECW, the WWF was also preparing to launch a new program of its own that fall called SmackDown, and Vince McMahon and his cohorts would need new talent to accommodate this expanded schedule. In one fell swoop, the WWF inked ECW's heavyweight and tag team champions to 3-year contracts for the Federation. The Dudley struck an agreement with Jim Ross in August, and Taz followed suit. A scant few weeks later, just as the TNN show was getting off the ground, just as action figures were being released for ECW for the very first time, the company had withstood countless injuries, countless blows to its roster in the past, but in losing three of its four champions, as well as three of its longest tenured talents, this was one of the most damaging talent raids to date, particularly given the timing, especially. What's more, despite the air of optimism permeating the company, house show business was on a downward trend for the first time in years, and pay-per-view buy rates had yet to display any growth. The TNN deal could not have come any later. Cable viewers had already been getting heaping helpings of the WWF and WCW for years. Now it was time to get their periodic plateful of extreme.
If you're watching for the all boobs and no brains show, well, you better get your thrill right now. Because before too long, it's all gonna be over. Because I'm running them out of town. Because I'm a star! I'm a star!
Tell it's nothing personal. It's business.
Yeah,
the more people
personal.
We run out of here, the more impact we make. It's like the tag team titles. We get rid of Raven, we get rid of Dreamer, we win the tag team titles. We make an impact.
Yeah.
It's not just a name. It's not just a moniker. It's a way of life. It's what we do.
Now that's not just the coolest.
Oh, yeah, it is.
And that's not just the best.
That's from Calgary, Alberta, Canada.
Now that, my friends, is just incredible.
Yo, I'm DeVito, and I'm the star,
and I'm Angel, and together,
we're the Baldies!
It's that time of year again. November to Remember is coming up.
Wait, Daddy.
And everybody's being able to count on their favorite wrestler, Rob Van Dam, defending the World Television belt. But they don't know who I'm wrestling. And Fonzie, since you're in charge of all of Rob Van Dam's wrestling affairs, I'm sure you know who I'm going to wrestle, right?
I just wanted to take this opportunity to let everyone know, the fans, and especially the Impact players, that in the 2 years with ECW, I didn't let a broken foot stop me, I didn't let a fractured pelvic bone stop me, and I'm sure as hell not going to let a couple of broken ribs stop me. So you can rest assured that I'm going to...
Will you stop your whining, you big crybaby, and work hurt like the rest of us?
What the hell?
Anyway, I just wanted to thank all the fans for all the support and for knowing that, screw it, that I don't take crap from a like that. Here, hold these.
Come on, Tommy. You see this? This is it. Okay, Tommy, I'm garbage. I'm a piece of crap. I've lived my life and I deserve what I get. Fonzie, I think the people want to see me beat Sabu's ass. You could arrange it. Hey, you know, think of it this way. You could get some of the winner's money, and I'm sure Sabu wouldn't mind splitting the loser's pay with you, too. Yeah.
So what am I going to do? Go to the gym? No, I ain't going to lift no weights. I'm going to go out, commit some crimes, run from the police, get in shape. I know nothing but violence. I know nothing but hardcore violence. I know nothing but beating your ass until I get tired. And it's going to be a lot different with me. You see, New Jack is on a mission.
Rob Van Dam in November Remember against any loser. It doesn't matter because Rob Van Dam always wins. They always get their money's worth. They always get what they expect, what they pay to see.
Rob Van Dam, Mr. Pay-Per-View. So, Fonzie, whoever you can get to wrestle me, bring them on. Everybody else, they're just paying to see me. Why? It's all part of being the whole show.
What began so promisingly was ultimately the final chapter of ECW. The first TNN show aired on August 27, 1999, and served as an introduction to the company's storylines and characters. It chronicled all of the big-name stars that had passed through ECW over the years, from Steve Austin to Mick Foley to Raven to the literally dozens of other full-time ex-ECW regulars plying their trades in the Big Two. Although the exhibit of past greats established the promotion's rich historical tapestry, many long-time followers observed how much it caused them to yearn for the ECW arena glory days. The final segment of the debut show featured a searing Taz interview that did an excellent job of establishing the company's outlaw image to the new audience. The program drew a 0.9 rating, which some touted as a major disappointment given TNN's expectations, while others maintained the number was solid relative to the network's other programming and stood only to grow in future weeks. It should note that initially, this show was supposed to be via the taped edition, like I mentioned, from a previous car that was meant to tape for TNN. Paul Heyman hated the way it was edited and combined to fit TNA's expectations and standards. Therefore, he decided to throw a best-of show, which became an introduction to ECW, which in turn seemed to make sense for new viewers, but it was initially supposed to be a brand new show of ECW, a brand new edition, with new storylines, new matches, but Heyman hated it. He was so particular, so hands-on with the product. He would not put on this new content if he was not satisfied with it. Therefore, the best of ECW was shown and in turn fit well as an introduction, an introductory piece for new fans. That same week, ECW stumbled upon an unexpected turn of good fortune. At a backstage meeting, Eric Bischoff promised to release any WCW wrestler who wanted out of the company. One of the wrestlers to call the bluff was Raven, because the WCW VP amended his original offer by denying the group that walked out the opportunity to sign with the WWF, the Radicals. That left ECW as the only viable alternative for those involved. As a result, the others opted to continue collecting the cushy Time Warner cash, of course, but not Raven. The former ECW heavyweight champion was on his way back home. On TNN's second ECW program, he made his triumphant return and, in an interesting twist, joined old nemesis Tommy Dreamer, his former foe, the Innovator of Violence, in winning the tag team titles from the Dudleys in the latter's final ECW match. When all thought the Dudleys would do the honors and leave, they actually regained the tag team titles, or retained them, I should say, and in turn, Tommy Dreamer brought out his mystery partner, Raven. The former fellows were now ECW Tag Team Champions. The Queens, New York crowd greeted the returning hero with a deafening ovation. I was in the audience. Goosebump City, folks. It was a great moment in ECW history. Paul Heyman now had his most multidimensional character back under his employ. Some felt Raven was just using ECW as a pass to wait until he was able to go to the WWF. Nevertheless, ECW had a coup in bringing back Raven.
The counter DDT.
this momentum continued to build. And in fact, it almost completely counteracted the wave of departures. Mike Awesome returned from his injury and headlined the September 19th Anarchy Rules pay-per-view in Chicago by winning the ECW title over the soon-to-be departing Taz. The card was very strong from top to bottom and drew the largest paid crowd, just under 6,000, in company history, with Lance Storm versus Jerry Lynn to Jerry versus Super Crazy versus Little Guido and Just Incredible versus Sabu, the other in-ring highlights of the card. Awesome was substantially larger than the remainder of the company's roster, and as such, he got over well as an athletic monster. He was a solid, a bit unspectacular champion. His subsequent matches with Spike Dudley were some of ECW's best of the year. In October, just as the wave of momentum, Raven's jump, was beginning to subside, WCW committed another faux pas and released the formerly known James Fullington, aka Hardcore Hack, aka the Sandman, the hardcore icon. Naturally, he re-debuted in ECW nearly a few days later, drawing a huge pop that even exceeded Raven's, and immediately entered into a feud with Just Incredible, whose top of the card heel push was intact. Fullington may have deteriorated physically, but the man with one of the richest histories and best entrances in ECW was back where he belonged. The hardcore icon back in the land of the extreme, back in the fold when ECW was on national television. Unfortunately, reports soon came back from cable companies that the Anarchy Rules pay-per-view did not show marked buy rate growth over ECW's previous pay-per-view efforts. By that time, it had already become painfully obvious that the ECW on TNN slot was far from a success. The first several episodes rendered numerous strong matches, including Jerry Lynn versus Rob Van Dam, Jerry Lynn versus Just Incredible, Van Dam versus Lance Storm, Tajiri versus Super Crazy, Masato Tanaka versus Rhino, Tanaka versus Awesome. However, the ratings inched downward, lowering to a 0.7 in late September. Desperate to reverse the trend, Heyman brought the embattled Tammy Sitch back into the fold, making her a frequent centerpiece of the show. This renewed push included one infamous program that featured Sonny discussing her personal troubles for almost the entire hour. Seeing that its pure wrestling focus was not drawing ratings, ECW also began conforming more to the storyline-focused style of wrestling it had created by dedicating more and more airtime to TNA. Scantily clad women, you could say, or catfights, as Joey Styles would blare out. Sitch, Tammy Lynn Bitch, also known as Dawn Marie, and Francine became the main selling points, as often as not, and relegated the in-ring wrestling to really an ancillary matter. Luckily, the ratings did grow. From October 99 through February of 2000, they ranged consistently from 1.0 to 1.3, right around where TNA is right now, as of this recording. Let's preface that. These numbers were excellent for a Friday night show on a struggling network, but TNN itself still consider them a disappointment. And it's amazing if fast forward now, TNN became Spike TV. Well, they went from the Nashville network to the national network to Spike TV, going from ECW to the WWF, now to TNA, and they went full circle, and they're back to that 1.0 to 1.3 range, originally on Thursday nights, and now moving over to Wednesdays. But ECW was still stuck within that 1.0 to 1.3 range. Growth, but not enough. The station, the channel, the corporate executives were looking for. ECW was never able to hit its stride fully on TNN. Even during the peak ratings period, its production value smacked of a minor league wrestling outfit. They were particularly embarrassing in comparison to the WWF's. Also, due to the overabundance of advertisements for ECW's other projects, the show often more closely resembled an infomercial for ECW merchandising. Their
pay-per-views, and house shows, more so than a self-contained, entertaining one-hour block of wrestling programming. Moreover, TNN placed greater than anticipated restrictions on raunchiness and violence. This deprived ECW of much of its essential hardcore appeal. It put handcuffs on the promotion, so to speak. Perhaps most frustrating of all for Paul Heyman was the fact that the network completely refused to advertise ECW on TNN on its other programming. Numerous wrestling fans who watched the network likely weren't even aware that it existed. Amazing. Worst yet, the show failed to jumpstart ECW's other revenue streams, despite the company's best efforts. Steadily, the company was plunging back into red ink. Some claim that initially TNN wanted ECW, but once they heard of the World Wrestling Federation being available, the potential to get the number one promotion rather than a third-rate bingo hall promoting company, their intrigue drifted away, and the once hopeful promotional juggernaut, or the promotional machine they were hoping to push ECW behind via a national cable company with the opportunity for primetime viewing, Friday nights initially, of course, but that was the hope to move ECW within the television ranks of their schedule, of their primetime schedule. The executives were hoping initially ECW to be a big thing, but once the opportunity of the number one promotion came arise, TNN executives seemed to lose their faith in ECW, and as a result, barely promoted the program on other TNN shows. There were some saving graces, however, among them Spike Dudley's great work, the Sinister Minister, formerly known as James Vandenberg, now known as Father James Mitchell. He was also known as Daryl Van Horn in WCW and Smoky Mountain, respectively. And Paul E. Dangerously spoof, Lou E. Dangerously, depicted by the former Sign Guy Dudley. A great angle involving Steve Corino, Balls Mahoney, and the reacquired Axel Rotten at a Limp Bizkit concert in November. But they seemed fewer in quantity than ever before. And in many storylines, they were characterized by unconditional disappointment. Raven was still the best interview in ECW, but he seemed uninspired. And it was as though he was lying in wait, like I mentioned before. He was set for his contract to be expired so that he could make a jump to the World Wrestling Federation. His weight ballooned, and the hard work, or the hard ring work that had once been an integral part of his success, fell by the wayside, at least partially due to cumulative injuries. He had also constantly squabbled with numerous members of the ECW locker room, not the least of whom was Heyman. His storyline with Tommy Dreamer was once the most brilliant in all of wrestling. Now it was just a trite, flat parody of itself. Moreover, Tammy Sitch's ratings drawing power didn't last, and before long, her personal problems materialized once again. In April, she jumped ship to WCW as part of the ill-fated Russo-Bischoff era. Mike Awesome's limitations began to show through as champion. He was large and athletic, but he lacked a dynamic personality. Sandman was not what he once was. New mid-card acts like Jack Victory, once a top prospect in the 80s, Roadkill, C.W. Anderson, and PN News weren't as imaginative as past ECW creations. Increasingly, one could not avoid the sense that ECW was no longer endeavored to be a legitimate competitor to the WWF and WCW. It simply endeavored to just simply survive. The November 7th, November to Remember 99 show was emblematic, to say the least, of the most disappointing period in ECW history. Though at that point, the company still had quite a bit of hope. Despite a good lineup, it was an average show that saw Rob Van Dam beat Taz in one of his final ECW appearances, Sabu defeating Chris Candido, Jerry Lynn beating Yoshihiro Tajiri and Super Crazy in a three-way dance, and a great Mike Awesome versus Masato Tanaka ECW brawl.
When I, you know, time went on and I wrestled in ECW and did the honors on the way out the door and blah, 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 blah. Then I debuted at the Royal Rumble at Madison Square Garden against Kurt Angle. I was Kurt's mystery opponent. Kurt was undefeated. On my way to the Garden, because I only live about 45 minutes from the Garden, I was driving to the Garden. I was, as you can imagine, so excited to debut for World Wrestling Entertainment for the McMahons in my hometown arena of Madison Square Garden. I mean, the arena. You know what I mean? Very nervous and very excited and a lot of emotions just flying through my body. And I'm on my way. I'm on the Long Island Expressway getting ready to come through the Midtown Tunnel to go to the Garden. I take my cell phone. I call Paul Heyman. I've never told this story publicly. And I said, Paul, it's Taz. He goes, what's going on? Now, we hadn't spoken for a long time, you know. I go, I'm assuming you know where I'm going right now. He goes, I thought you'd be there by now. He goes, you're going to the Garden, you know. I said, yeah. And he goes, congratulations. He goes, I know that means a lot to you. I said, yeah, it does. You know, it's choking me up right now because I've always had three goals when I first started wrestling. And they were, I've always wanted to just make a living as a wrestler. Didn't matter how much money I was making. I just loved it and I wanted to make a living. Second, I wanted to hold any kind of championship at least once in my career, any kind, because it meant that the company put stock in you that you could hold a championship. And it didn't matter what type of champ, anyone. And the third was I always wanted to wrestle at Madison Square Garden, just one time. And I figured while I was in ECW and everything was going great, well, two out of the three goals aren't bad. Because I knew working for ECW, I'd never get to work at the Garden. But then when I left ECW and I knew I was going to debut for the WWE at the Garden, I'm like, geez, my goals have been completed. You know what I mean? And anyway, Paul says, I know that's important to you that you're going to wrestle at the Garden. He goes, I'm proud of you and I'm happy for you. And, you know, he's like, well what are... He said, why'd you call? And I said, I said, I just wanted your blessing. You know, and he gave it to me. He said, kick ass, you're gonna. So, you know, it was just, God, I talk about a guilt trip, you know. I felt so guilty, you know. I felt good, but I felt guilty, you know. That seems like ages ago. But crying. It's just, you know, it. When you are. When you learn so much from someone and you respect someone so much, then you have a bad fallout with them. And people pass judgment on you, and you're the bad guy. You're the sellout, which is a crock of shit. You know, and then you call a guy, and he supports you. Now, then I start second-guessing myself, you know. And I told Paul that, and he talked me out of it. So don't do that. He's a very misunderstood guy. I've said things about Paul when I'm angry at him. Not in a long time, I haven't. Behind his back. And I'm sure he said things behind my back. I mean, people do that. But I know how much ECW meant to Paul. It was his life. It wasn't just something he loved. It wasn't just something he worked so hard for. It was his life. No girlfriend, no wife, no close friends. Just people that worked for him were his closest friend. That was his family. And I cannot begin to tell you how much he cared and the passion he had to the likes of Vince McMahon sacrificing and Linda McMahon sacrificing what they did here to bring WrestleMania 1. To the forefront, you know, the sacrifices Vince, same as the sacrifices Heyman did. Vince just happened to go all the way and was successful with it. And I think Paul was a success, too. I definitely think Paul was a success. Wish it ended different for him. Because when I left there, I was in the WWE. I was so concentrated and focused on being a WWE guy. I knew I had this history and this past, but I needed to move on with my career. And Paul knew that, and he told me that, and I knew it anyway. You know, you can't look back, you got to go forward. And I started to do that, but I would keep an eye on ECW, and I wanted them to succeed so bad. I swear I did, you know? And I think they did succeed. Just wish it would have went a little longer for them.
Some of the notable moments in 1999, we saw the ECW Arena featured around the United States and Canada as TV tapings were done for TNN. The arena got the national exposure. This allowed fans to see what the arena experience was all about. Lucha and Japanese talent again made their way into the ECW Arena as Del Norte, Taka Michinoku, Super Crazy, El Mosco de la Merced, Yoshihiro Tajiri, Mr. Aguila, aka Papi Chulo. This gave us matches over the 1999 year, such as Jerry Lynn versus Tajiri, Super Crazy versus Del Norte, Taka versus Papi Chulo, and a series of Super Crazy Tajiri matches that were unbelievable. We got a Match of the Year nominee for the second time with Rob Van Dam versus Jerry Lynn from the August 28th show. Some of the other names seen in ECW and the ECW Arena during 99 included Skull Von Crush, aka Big Vito, Bill Wiles, David Cash, Uganda, Tom Marquez, Kid Cash, Bo and Jack Dupp, and Ikuto Hidaka. And as ECW closed the book in 1999, their future was in jeopardy. Could they survive this route on TNN? Could they overcome this lack of exposure, even though they were on a national television network? Could they counter losing this the championship talent, such as Taz and the Dudleys? Could they find new stars to counter the lackluster performance of the returning Raven and Sandman? Could 2000 be a revitalized year for ECW? As we'll cover in the next edition of ECW 101, it was the start of the end for the land of the extreme.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
No matter how hard you try, you can't stop us now.
Hey guys, it's me, Mr. Money on the Mic, Jeff Jackson. The SNS Radio Network is recently affiliated with UnblockUs.com. If you go to the SNS Radio Network page and click the UnblockUs.com banner ad, you can sign up to get a VPN. Not sure what a VPN is? Well, it basically protects your identity online. Basically, it gives you an address online where the content you want becomes available. Here's how it works. When you click the link on the SNS Radio Network banner, it takes you to UnblockUs.com, and from that link, you can sign up for a free one-week trial. You decide to sign up afterward, it's only $4.99 a month. And when you think about it, that's great savings. $4.99 a month allows you to watch American Netflix or any region of Netflix that you'd like to watch. And here's the biggie, folks. If you don't have the WWE Network, you live in the UK, you live in another country outside the United States, UnblockUs.com can set you up for $4.99 a month with a VPN that will allow you to have access to the WWE Network and all regions of Netflix. And you can watch it on your PS3, your Xbox 360, any device you have, you're able to use with UnblockUs.com. And the best part about it is, I'm not just talking about this, I'm using this service myself. So once again, go to the SNS Radio Network, click on the Unblock Us banner, and from there, sign up. And if you do that, you help to support the SNS Radio Network as they give a kickback to us to help keep all the shows on the SNS Radio Network for free. Once again, UnblockUs.com, giving you freedom online.
All systems operating within normal design parameters.
Students, class is in session. Professor Sean Beckerman takes you back in time to relive WCW 101, the history of World Championship Wrestling. Relive the historic rise and fall of WCW on Beyond the Bell, your pro wrestling nostalgia podcast on the SNS Radio Network. Listen to the entire series now at btbcast.com.
everyone. This is your hardcore country knockout, Mickey James, and you're listening on the SNS Radio Network.
Hey now, listen up. I'm not the kind of girl that ever gives up. If anybody tries to bring me down.
Well, students, that closes the book on another chapter. We turn the page to a new chapter in ECW history as we close the books on 1999. A lot happened in that year, like I stated at the top of our program. Taz and the Dudley Boys leaving to go to the World Wrestling Federation. Raven leaving WCW to go back to ECW. So does the Sandman. Some felt, though, that Raven was only using ECW as a stopgap before he can go to the WWF. The Extreme Company lands a deal on the former Nashville Network, now known at the time as the National Network, TNN. High hopes, big expectation, and it would soon lead to letdowns. It all started with the very first show that Paul Heyman wanted to put out. Wasn't satisfied putting a best of show on. And with the handcuffs and restrictions that TNN put on them, ECW was doomed from the start. With pay-per-view ratings declining and buy rates declining, TV ratings declining, pay-per-view buy rates declining, what would happen to the Extreme promotion in the year 2000? The dawning of a new era as the WWF is headed towards its peak in business. What would happen to the Extreme promotion? Could they survive ECW on TNN? Could they survive the downswing in buy rates and ratings? Could they survive this talent raid that affected them more than ever, taking away their champions, their tag team and world champions? Could Paul Heyman emerge and bring some future stars, potential stars, and making them current stars in 2000? A lot of questions, a lot of work needed to be done for ECW just to survive. Now, with 1999 coming to a close, we look ahead to the year 2000. As WCW was on a downward trend, so seemed ECW in a sense. And on the next edition of ECW 101, our next class, we will analyze the downfall and death of ECW. What caused this once successful hardcore promotion to go down in flames? Would Paul Heyman abandon ship before the doors even closed on the promotion? We'll break it down in detail on the next edition of the History of Extreme Championship Wrestling here on Beyond the Bell. This month of BTB programming is going to be exciting, fans. We announced it on Twitter. The month of September is going to be red hot with retro audio for all old school fanatics. As we lead into the death of ECW, as I just mentioned, this month we'll also cover the dying days of world-class championship wrestling. We'll look back in detail of the years 1988 and 1989 and the milestones in world-class championship wrestling. What led to the eventual downfall and end of the world-class Texas-based promotion? We cover that this month on Beyond the Bell. The Stone Cold Chronicles returns, and we highlight the year 2002, a very controversial year in the Rattlesnake's career. Arguably, and it's really hard to even argue that, Stone Cold's most controversial year, as we would see him leave the promotion. We'll cover in detail the events that led up to his eventual walkout prior to his match with Brock Lesnar on Monday Night Raw. We're going to look back at three of the most famous feuds in professional wrestling. We'll provide an introductory history lesson on the rivalries involving the Rock and Roll Express versus the Midnight Express and Sergeant Slaughter versus the Iron Sheik. And we'll go in great detail of the historic battles, and we'll go into great detail of the historic rivalry between the immortal Hulk Hogan and Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. Famous Feuds returns this month on Beyond the Bell. We also open up once again the Horseman Files as we look back at the history of the legendary stable, the Four Horsemen. This month we cover the early 90s, and in celebration of the debut series on the WWE Network, As we get ready for the conclusion of two of our series, ECW 101 and the world-class milestones of WCCW, I decided to launch a brand new series. This five-part series debuts with part one of the Monday Night War, the battle between WCW Monday Nitro and WWF Monday Night Raw. This will be a great complement to the network series. All this and more coming up this month on Beyond the Bell. Now, I know we're all sad that ECW 101 may be coming to a close, but it may not end as soon as you think. As even though we're wrapping up the history of ECW, we can always talk about the extreme promotion, always find topics to discuss. Once we conclude our chronological order of history of ECW, we'll bring a special edition back, as we'll cover possibly the top 10 greatest moments, or relive just some of the greatest moments of Extreme Championship Wrestling. Some of the most shocking, extreme, and memorable moments in ECW's history will be covered on a special edition of Beyond the Bell, and we're going to mix in some of the greatest extreme music, some of the greatest theme songs for the extreme superstars of ECW. We'll mix those two components together and have a great special ECW edition in the coming weeks on Beyond the Bell. So stay tuned for that special. ECW fans, I promise you, this won't be the end. But that is the end for this week of Beyond the Bell. Check out all of the archive shows at btbcast.com. Every weekend, we're streamed live at snsradionetwork.com. Subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn Radio apps. So let's take it home with some extreme theme music. We discussed his departure in 1999 from ECW, as he decided to join the World Wrestling Federation and make his debut at the Royal Rumble 2000. ECW World Champion, the Human Suplex Machine, Taz, would make 1999 his final year in the promotion full-time. Next edition of ECW 101, we'll discuss his return briefly, but still a WWF superstar, but he does make a comeback to the hardcore organization. But in celebration of his departure, we're going to take it home with Taz's last theme in ECW, Survive If I Let You, which really originated from War Machine, his original ECW theme. And over the years, it morphed into what was his final version in Extreme Championship Wrestling. It would be briefly used when he made his return, a part of WWECW. We'll get into that, of course, later on. When the WWF brought ECW back, Taz did come out to this theme song. But this was his official last Extreme Championship Wrestling theme, and we'll take it home with some Taz here on Beyond the Bell. So until next week, fans, when we rewind and relive all things retro and wrestling, this is your Extreme Ring announcer, Sean Beckerman, signing off until next week. Stay hardcore, my friends.
just another victim.
Gentlemen, anybody out there watching, we're a unit. The Four Horsemen are not four individuals.
Anytime you see the Four Horsemen together, it's something special.
We are the Stunts in professional wrestling.
Were you a kiss-stealing, wheeling-dealing, limousine-rodding, jet-flying son of a gun? Well, then you will love the Horseman Files on Beyond the Bell, your pro wrestling nostalgia podcast. Host Sean Beckerman breaks down the history of one of the most illustrious groups in professional wrestling, the Four Horsemen. Each edition breaks down each year in Horseman history and the impact they played on the industry. So get your bomber jacket and aviator sunglasses ready and tune into the Horseman Files on Beyond the Bell here on the SNS Radio Network.
I don't want to blow our own horn, but toot toot.
We're the best team in professional wrestling throughout history.